is as eager, not nervous, eager. And Romney, these final days, walking to the back of the campaign.
Love Talk Radio.
Yeah, right.
This is Romney.
Love Talk Radio.
Bravo.
Hi, this is Joseph G. with the good news of 12-step recovery, Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. Actually, the unknown universe is about the unseen, the unknown universe. I'd like to introduce... I would like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Arkansas as a public service presentation. We would like also to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals that affords us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does the fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. As the family goes, so does the country. Harold?
Hello, Joseph, and hello, everybody. It's my pleasure to be here and help out in any way that I can. This is my way of giving back. I owe God a great deal for my recovery. Every day of it is a gift from God. And it's over 8,000 days so far. My sobriety date is December 28th, 1987. And I take it one day at a time. And I haven't had a need to drink or use drugs in all those days. And so I like to give back in several different ways. Helping families is one. And working with Joseph on the website and on the radio program is another. This website and radio program are dedicated to working with other people. One of the main things that keeps me sober is working with others, and that's one of the principles in recovery from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that working with others is successful when all other things fail. So here we are, and this is offered as a public service. The radio program originates in Nashville and that area. The website originates in Houston and is seen all over the world, including China, including Mississippi, as Joseph says. And Joseph doesn't make a penny from this effort. In fact, it costs him dearly to keep the website going and update the website continually, which he does, and I'm really impressed with that. So that's what we're doing. We're explaining how to recover, how to work the steps, and the main technique involves working with other people. You only get to keep what you give away in the world of recovery. So he and I are here, and let me turn it back over to Joseph. Joseph?
Yeah, thanks, Harold. Well, you know, 12-step recovery is all based on the basic text of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Prior to writing of the big book, and all 12-step programs, let me remind you, comes from that basic text and that basic understanding, which was a compilation of information from the Oxford group. They had six steps and four absolutes. And prior to that,
pardon me? 1935.
Yeah, it was 1935, and the Oxford group was still in business. So there was, people were addressing, and prior to that was the Washingtonians, who were trying to address this, and this was during the Civil War era. That's when they started. Do you know that, Harold?
No. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was alcohol has been a plague to man and has been since the crack of dawn. The first incidences of alcohol was in Egypt. Some people think it might have even been prior to that, but that's recorded, or with the glyphs and things, they've come to that understanding. Prior to that, they're not sure, but they could have been even before that. But for sure, prior to building the pyramids, we had beer. And it was one of the things that promoted civilization, was the making of barley to produce alcohol. There was a show I had seen one time on PBS, and it showed the evolution of beer and the evolution of mankind when hand in glove. One of the benefits from the workers that built the pyramids was beer. They would get an allotment of beer every day while they were building the pyramids. Get them happy. And, of course, it was pretty hot, so cold beer goes a long way. I don't know if it was cold at the time, but it did the job for sure. I've had warm beer when I was in Vietnam. We were in an armored personnel carrier, and we'd stop at the Ville on the way out. And we would get ice because we had that mechanization. We had conveyance. We'd get ice, and we'd have cold beer for a day or so, and then the ice melted. But since we had large cargo capacity, we could carry 3, 4, 5 cases of beer. So it was not uncommon, and it wasn't like we're in heavy traffic. We're out in the jungle somewhere. So it wasn't like if you were going to get loaded while you were driving this thing that you were going to hit another car or something. So it was fairly common to drink warm beer out there. And, you know, you get used to everything. I used to say the meetings, you know, I used to live in hell, but I was comfortable there because I knew where all the light switches were. I'm a firm believer that the human condition will get used to just about anything when it's exposed to it long enough. So, having said that, I'd like to start the program off with the third step prayer. Now, we had an interview tonight, Ray Lynch, and last minute, I think it was the daylight savings that might have thrown him, and he didn't make himself available. So we'll do this again sometime with Ray, and so we're going to just take a regular format tonight. And I think you'll find it interesting because recovery is interesting. I'd like to start off with the third step prayer that's found on page 63 of the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the third step prayer is very important to me in the recovery process as a sponsor. When I look for a sponsee, I'll do this. We circle up at the end of a meeting. In some clubs, they say, or groups, they say the third step prayer. Sometimes they say Our Father, sometimes they say something else, but there's usually some kind of ending to the group discussion in the form of a group acknowledgement. I like to think of it as a benediction. It's a form of gratitude that we had invited the Spirit there, we learned from each other, and we were enlivened. And then we say a prayer of one type or another. And after that, we do that. I go around the circle, and I try to grab the man's hand. I believe it's men with men and women with women. It seems to work out better that way. The key is to work the steps. That's not a hard and fast rule. Actually, we have no rules. What we have is suggestions. Because if we had rules, we'd have exceptions to the rules, so it doesn't work for us. We're just a group of anarchists by heart. So I grab the newcomer. He's just gotten his beginner's chip, so he's hot and ready to go. After the prayer, I turn around to him. I says, "Have you had enough? Yes or no?" If he's had enough, he'll know what you're talking about. Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Very important question. Yes. And then I tell them, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is, and I carry these with me, they're Clancy's 7 questions. You can find them on the rumradio.org website. They're listed under the sponsor, how to find the sponsee tab. Scroll down a little ways, and you'll see the Clancy 7 questions. They're nice. They're not like a little mini fourth step. Some probing questions are asked. It's not so important how he answers the question. What's important is this next simple instruction. I need these questions answered, and I need them back tomorrow. Not the day after tomorrow, not the dog ate my homework. I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. Expect your call. If I get them back, he's taken a simple instruction, and he's already involved in getting into recovery by working this. So we're started. We got a good kickstart. If I don't get him back, one of two things have happened. He's either not ready or he's not ready for you. And that's okay, because then he might need somebody else, or he hasn't he's not in enough pain yet to make a decision to try to work a recovery program. And this is essential. I don't chase him. So now once I get that, one of the first assignments I give him is for him to get the names of 20 or 30 men in his home group to get a home group. A home group is where you're regularly going to go for AA meetings or whatever your flavor of addiction. You get to know the people in there. It's your home group. It's your lifeline. And to pass around either a newcomer's packet, if they have it in that particular group, or just a list. You go there a few minutes early prior to the beginning of the meeting and ask the chairperson if he would pass around a list of names of men who are willing to take your phone call. And most fellas do. Most people agree to that. To give you permission to do that. And every day for the next 30 days, I want you to call one of the men on the list and ask their permission to recite the third step prayer. It's also called the surrender prayer. It has a couple things it does, and I always tell a sponsee why I give them an assignment, why I give them a reading, what 12-step principles involved in it. We're adults. I think knowledge is power. And one of the first reasons I give them to do that is they get used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Most people have a hard time with that initially. It's a good way to get started. This is your lifeline. Two, you get to know the people's names in your home group. They get to know your name. Oh, this is interesting. The third step prayer encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the fellow he's calling might have been considering picking up his first drink of alcohol. And when you call him, the chances are he will not. So your sponsee's already into action of service. Now, there's no guarantees in this, but I find this to be very productive, and it works really well. A lot of the fellas, and I tell them right up front, most of the fellas I work with attain and maintain long-term sobriety in AA. I'm nobody special, far from it. I'm just another average, run-of-the-mill, garden-variety drunk. But what I found is certain procedures, techniques, and tools prove to be beneficial through experience. My experience tells me that this worked before, and there's a good chance it'll work again, and I tell my sponsees that. So if nothing else, they have in their mindset, oh, so until they get used to, depending on the program, depending on AA or whatever the flavor is, or depending on God, they can start depending on me a little bit. Now, then I can wean them off me and get them depending only on God. But initially, you need somebody to lean on. You're it. Now, this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee. To build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Thank you, Harold. Well, tonight I thought what we would do is I had an experience. I've been giving out Rum Radio cards, little business cards. Has a little, it's cute. Had Stepologist on there. At Sobriety Beach, has some palm trees, a lagoon, a little set of stairs, and I have my title as Stepologist. Doesn't mean anything. It's cute. Someone to get, you know, smile. You get a smile out of it. You got somebody's attention. Has the term, as the road narrows, the view does broaden. And sponsorship. A look back to the future. And that's what Rum Radio is supposed to do. We're taking a look back at a back-to-basics approach to sponsorship. It's interesting because that's when we found it to be the most productive. And I think because of the rehabs and because of the way we've spun off into outer space and some clubs and groups, that we don't hold to the original simple concepts that worked the best in the beginning. So I'm saying, hey, let's take a look back. Let's see how they did it. Let's see. In the big book, it says, wow, 75% of the people that go through this stay and the other 25% later on. Wow, that's a pretty good 100%. You can't beat 100% recovery rate. It's just not going to happen. We don't find that to be the lay of the land today. We don't really know. But it just seems that it's not so. So anytime I use this approach, it seems to work really well, and I believe the old timers really had a handle on it. What do you think, Harold?
Well, I like that idea. The thing is, one of the efforts that we're trying to do here for our listeners is to go back to basics and to undo some of the error thinking that's developed somehow, and that's part of it. Say, I see a phone number for Ray Lynch here on the web. Shall I call it, Joseph? Why don't you continue to read and let me call this number.
Harold, you don't call it. You just click it like you did with mine.
Well, no, I'm on a different website. So let me go on my phone and give him a call, see what happens.
Okay. Is that on the panel?
Oh, let me double check on the panel. No, nothing on the panel.
Okay.
So,
I don't get it then.
I've got a 707 number that I found looking him up on the web.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't understand what that. I thought he called in.
Yeah, no, I found his number on the web.
Okay, go ahead.
But you go ahead and handle
well,
the problem, and I'll
give
call
you a little heads up with the cards. I was up in North Houston, and I was getting a haircut, and since I was in that neck of the woods, there's some clubs up there, and one of them is Champions Forest. It's up in Northwest Houston. It's an A group. It's been there several years since last my visit there, and I thought it had been an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope, and to most certainly pass out some rumradio.org recovery business cards in that area. So, you know, I'm there. The time is right. My original sponsor, Kenneth, had told me, The only AA meeting you're ever late for is your first one. As long as you make it to the closing prayer, you're right on time. And I found this to be true. If I'm in a neighborhood and I'm running late, I go to a meeting. And I've gone into meetings, not often, but it's happened, where I walked in for the last share. And, you know, that was funny. I needed to hear what that fella had to say. God works in strange ways sometimes when you put in the effort. Sometimes I've walked in and it was the closing prayer. And I got this the closing prayer, and then I hung out for the meeting after the meeting, and that worked out fine too. So I'm in the neighborhood, so I'm going to the meeting, but it was still pretty early. Before entering, I had met someone new to the program, and he explained that he had 90 days.
I said, well, that's great. Congratulations, newcomer. I had asked him, were you going to be getting your 90-day chip? We get little discs commemorating milestones, especially in the first year. Are you going to get your 90-day chip at the meeting? He said, no, was his reply. I drank yesterday, so now I only have 89 days. That's a joke. We had once met before, and he was now working twice as hard, determined to get down to the core of his causes and conditions. He had relapse. And I had met him before, and I had given him a card, and that's how I knew we had met before. But he'd gone out, and it was a slip, and he was coming back in, which is always good to see. You're always welcome. Now, the term is we don't shoot our wounded. Come in and out sometimes. It's a revolving door for some folks. We don't like to see it that way. Our preamble says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. To those that will not or cannot give themselves to this simple program, there are such unfortunates. They just seem to have been born that way. There's those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. They too can get well if they have the capacity to be honest. That's the key to recovery, is to be honest. Sometimes we've lied so much to ourselves, we've lied so much to the world, that we lied even when the truth would have served us better. The curse of the liar is not that nobody believes him, it's that he can't believe anybody. So we have to learn to be honest. Do you have any luck, Harold?
No luck. I want to try one other thing, so keep going. I'll be right back.
Sure. I entered the broad doorway that led to the half measures room. That's the social gathering place, the rumpus room, the coffee bar. We call it half measures room because in the preamble it says, half measures availed us nothing. So that's when we were half-stepping. We didn't want to give ourselves to the simple program, but we did some of it. And then we call those half measures. So instead of going to a meeting, some people hang out there and they talk. So we always call them the half measures room. You know, they're just hanging out. I was immediately attacked by the acrid stench of countless years of secondhand tobacco smoke. Some of the regular lounge lizards were dragging away on their fire-breathing cigarettes and passing time while playing card games and dominoes. It was a smoking group. My original home group was a smoking group. They originally started in Austin. They broke away from whatever home group that was, and there was a breakaway. And because they were smokers and they wanted to start a club where there was smoking, and that was the main platform other than relief from alcoholism, was so they could smoke. These were smokers. I want to smoke, and so I'm going to start a club that availed itself to smoking. And I went in there, and I quit smoking, and it was a tough place, but I hated to go because it was my home group. But after, you know, I haven't smoked in 15 years, so now I'm almost polarized to this stuff. I believe there's a connection. You know, we quit alcohol, and some folks, that's as far as they're going to go. This is about quitting alcohol. This is not about quitting cigarettes or overeating or any of that. Some people really dig their heels in. They've given up their main drug of choice, and they're going to participate in their secondary drugs of choice, even if it kills them, and it usually does. So I tried to place myself downwind and then realized there was no downwind, as the smoke seemed to have a mind of its own and was determined to follow me wherever I would go. If you're a non-smoker, you know exactly what I'm doing. No matter where you go, that smoke seems to find you. I don't know if it's spiritual, if it's polarity. There's just something about it. I scooted and skirted around the ever-thickening billows and tried to engage in light conversation as to the memories when smoking and AA was part and parcel. Most AA groups in the beginning and for many, many years were smoking groups. That's when smoking was an integral part of America. Not as much anymore. The kids still smoke a lot, which, sorry to say, but back then, most AA groups had smoking in it. Cigar smoke, pipe smoke, and especially cigarette smoke. That was probably one of the jobs newcomers had, was cleaning the ashtrays. I remember that. Funky ashtrays had to be cleaned, and, you know, and then the wall, I remember in the Hope group, the walls would get like this yellow tinge to them from the amount of acrid tobacco stain that would be dripping off the walls. Bill W., one of our co-founders, died in part because of tobacco addiction, even conceding that not only was it doing harm to himself, but to his ever-dutiful wife, Lois. And Dr. Bob is more likely to help speed up his untimely departure, too, was tobacco. So tobacco's been a big part. There's not too many people that would drink and not smoke. It was all like part and parcel. And secondhand smoke, people don't realize why. Secondhand smoke is even worse than the first and regular smoke. And what I've discerned was the reason for that is that when you take in a cigarette, when you take in the inhale a cigarette, the tip of that cigarette is at about 452 degrees Fahrenheit. And I think it's Fahrenheit 452, I think it was a movie by that name. And so when you inhale a cigarette, it's a vapor because of the heat. And then then you take it in and then you blow it out. Well, you've cooled the smoke and the tar comes out as little fine micro droplets. And, of course, anybody in the vicinity is going to suck in those micro droplets, and they're going to adhere themselves to the inside of the lung. Ooh, baby. And it's hard to get out. So that's why some people die. The guy was a smoker. His wife wasn't a smoker. He survived. She died. Now, of course, you know, this is still about addiction. People don't look at it that way, but I'll tell you, as a smoker, tobacco addiction is a real addiction. Nicotine is probably one of the big demons on the planet. More people die from nicotine than from alcohol. As many people die from alcohol, I think five times as many from smoking. And, of course, you want to go to an AA meeting, and, of course, the argument's always the same. Look, you don't have to smoke, but I have to breathe. And, of course, the common retort is, if you don't like it here, go somewhere else, which I don't believe is really a good program. You can leave the room, go outside and have a smoke, come back. You can't smoke at church. You can't smoke in the restaurants. There's a lot of places you can't smoke in the movies. So you can go an hour without a smoke, or you can go a half an hour without a smoke to impede on. But no, I think this is the addictive personality is self-centered in the extreme. What do you think, Harold? Is that your experience?
Oh, it really is. And a good friend of mine was addicted to heroin and addicted to nicotine, and he said that it was twice as easy to kick heroin than it was to kick cigarettes. Years ago, there was a lot of smoking in a lot of places, and there was a lot of kidding ourselves about smoking. And so nowadays, I think people are willing to get more honest with themselves, and so we see smoking in fewer places. As time goes on, fewer and fewer places allow smoking or have moved it outside. Some don't even allow it outside. So it's very interesting, very interesting to me. I never smoked cigarettes. My problem wasn't tobacco. But there are many different forms of addiction, forms of chemical dependency, and another problem we're seeing more, that I'm seeing more and more in the area of helping families and helping people with their dependency problems, people are gambling and they're addicted to porn, and those are very powerful addictions also. Now with the new brain scans, we can see what viewing porn does to the brain. It's very, very similar to cocaine. And this is well known now. I used to get a lot of raised eyebrows and people gasping, but it's not surprising people anymore. The brain research has become quite well known, and it's valuable information and it's popular information. People like knowing what the facts are. After they get over the initial shock, the idea that looking at images of naked women could be like a drug, it's exactly like a drug on the brain. And then there's the question, every one of those girls is somebody's daughter. Once you've had a daughter, it should change the whole thing. It should make you think. And it should make a man quit viewing things like that when he has a daughter. It should. It doesn't always, but it should. Joseph?
You know, it's funny you should mention it. It did for me. I had gone several times to the topless bars, and then all of a sudden I heard that my daughter was at a topless bar, and it completely changed my viewing. Now it was like I could relate to looking at someone else's daughter. And it was not a comfortable feeling at all.
And your daughter was grown at that time, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yes. So
that's a hard pill for dad to swallow.
There's another series of thoughts that I find really interesting and sadly disappointing, and that's when I've talked to so many men who have decided to cheat on their wives and have casual sex outside the marriage, and one of the aspects that I insist on discussing in the effort to save the marriage is, what about STDs? Weren't you worried about bringing something home and your wife getting an STD because of your indiscretions? And some of these guys look at me like I'm from a different planet, like I was talking a different language. They have no idea what I'm talking about. It took me 45 minutes to explain. I should have had diagrams to show, but it was like talking to a brick wall. He just had never given a moment's thought to the fact that by having casual sex, even so-called protected sex, that condoms have a 30% fail rate on average around the world. And so there is no such thing as safe sex. And he is risking giving his wife an STD and making his baby motherless. They have no idea what I'm talking about. Some guys. Now, of course, some do. And you're educated, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. But
sure.
Men out there, I'm telling you, when you have casual sex, you are risking not only catching an STD in the process, but spreading HIV, the HIV virus, because it has a six-month incubation period during which you can spread it, but it doesn't show symptoms. So write that down, talk to your doctor. We've got to be educated. We've got to be smart if we're going to survive these modern times. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. When I walked into this group, and it reminded me of the militancy of tobacco addiction. The common agreement seemed to be we've given up alcohol, and that's as far as any of us are willing to go. This is about alcohol, not about tobacco. And I really believe that the excessive, compulsive, addictive personality will latch on to anything it could get its hands on. And, you know, if you're going to smoke and you're not going to drink, you're right. It's not about tobacco. This is about alcohol. And you're not drinking? Okay. I'm not God. I don't want to play God. I used to play God. It's too hard. You know, I have to accept people. I don't have to put myself in a position to be harmed. And they're quite correct. I could go somewhere else. So that's what how that is. But at this time, I wanted to do some good there. Matter of fact, there's a story here in Houston. The violence, there was violence involved at one of the AA clubs about quitting smoking. This was several years ago. It was a fellow down there, Dudley, kind of like an AA guru down at Post Oak. And he was trying to, educated fellow, you know, and he was trying to get a tobacco-free environment. And Dudley was met with outrage and violent opposition. And this is a high-end club. This isn't a low-end club I'm talking about. These are doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs for the most part. Not all, but for the most part. Someone was so irate about him trying to push that agenda that somebody set his car on fire in retaliation.
Fair enough.
Yeah, he had formidable logic and reason. And they weren't gonna listen to that and the common sense and all that, and he was making inroads with it, and they were gonna show their displeasure. Or one fella, I'm sure it was just one, had such a argument about it, set his car on fire. So that'll give you an idea when the addict. Their drug is and you know, it's not like you go outside and smoke. It's not like somebody's going to take your cigarettes away. You could just walk outside. But that's, people get so stuck in the way things are done that any change at all brings out violent opposition.
Well, the interesting. Many interesting things have occurred, but one was surrounding the arrangement of the chairs. People are willing to fist fight over that, right?
That I've seen that happen. That's rare, and I hate to even put it over the air. It's more of a calmer AA. Alcoholics have a tendency to be very controlling. There's a lot of control issues involved. If you look back into the history of AA, the first time a group went into the prisons, there was a fist fight outside of the prisons because a group in AA decided that that wasn't the thing to do, that it would lower the standard. The drunk is always worried about someone lowering their standard. And there was a fist fight about AA going into the prisons. It's not common. Of course, you know, we've grown up to some degree, and these things usually don't happen as much anymore. I think it's a kinder, softer AA than it was back in the heyday. But there's still a lot of resentment for change, still there. That hasn't changed, but not as the violent opposition you don't find as much anymore. Although I've had some of myself with Rum Radio, like you know. Any new idea is first met, and that's just not AA, but the alcoholic is the extreme example of self-will run riot. The extreme. Not the only. This is common in the world. This is common to man, but he's the extreme example. Any new idea is always first met with ridicule. Well,
I've been in recovery over
opposition
years.
Passes away, acceptance being self-evident. Harold, you trying to say something?
Yes. I've been in recovery over 24 years and attending meetings in many different cities, and gradually I've seen more and more resistance to working with others, reluctance to go out and do 12-step calls, and fewer people getting sponsors, and fewer people working the steps, and it really worries me. I think in some ways AA has become wimpy. Not every AA meeting, not every AA group, not every city, but many places, there's a wimpiness that's developed. It takes courage to go out, meet other people, give this away, take your time, give your time freely. There's no pay for this, except we get to stay in recovery, which is wonderful pay for me. That's why I'm here right now. People, I don't know exactly what it is. People aren't getting it. They don't understand that you, in order to keep it, you've got to give it away. And there are fewer old timers, but I think even those old timers get kind of comfortable in their ways, and they don't want to get off the couch. I don't know. I'd love to be proved wrong. You folks out there that are doing a lot of 12-step work and that are working with others and really dedicated to it, give us a call. Write us an email. Prove me wrong, please, because if it keeps going like it is, AA will diminish and diminish and diminish. It's not keeping pace with the growth in population. It's not keeping pace with the number of alcoholics in the world, in the United States or in the world, and I'm worried about it. So November 2012 right now, and I'd love to be proved wrong. People are supposed to get out and vote here in a couple days, and I think people should get up and get out and do 12-step work, and especially in the big book, it says that helping the family members is a big thing that helps recovering people, guys with drinking problems who've decided to quit drinking. Their families need help, and I see hardly any of that. So people in recovery, prove me wrong, please. But I'm worried. I'm worried about AA these days. And this fighting over stupid things is part of the problem. You know, they get up in arms about their cigarettes or about the way the chairs are arranged, but they don't really get upset about the important things. So, well, that's the end of my little speech.
The validity. There's a validity to that. 1981, there was 2 million in the rooms, counting cats, but that was GSO, counting cats all through the world. That's the world count. 2010, 29 years later, January 2010, 2,100,000. The world population had increased by a full third at that point. Now that's 2 years ago. I don't know what it is. I've spoken to people. I've called the GSO, and I've talked to people recently within the last 6 months from GSO touring this area, and they confirm these numbers. One thing that I found of interesting just recently is on the GSO website, the AA website, there's a section where there's public announcements, public service announcements where AA is promoting AA. The thing people have said, isn't that against the traditions, our 11 tradition, press radio, not to promote and press radio and films. And the what they get back is that nobody's using the name. I still believe that's a form of promotion, and I don't care. To me, all the traditions come to one question. Does it divert us from our primary purpose, or does it enhance it? So I don't see any problem with that. What I see, though, is a symptom of the waning numbers. That's what I see when I see that. The need to promote hadn't happened in all these years. Now, all of a sudden, there's a need to promote, and that's validating the loss of numbers. Of course, you know, every church has got their own 12-step program, and, you know, then there's all kinds of different variations of the 12 steps. Every church has got, half of them got their own 12-step program, which is a knockoff of the original. Anytime you copy the original, it's never as good as the original. You ever notice that? There's always a frayed edge on a photocopy, on a print. It's not quite the same, and I believe that's what happened. I ask my church, if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? This thing works great when you work it. When it's worked the way it was designed to work in a timely and thorough manner, it works like a charm. It's when we try to vary from the original intent of the text, we run into problems. And we have these mid-timers that had the rehab people and keep coming back. They've turned sponsorship into a dating program. Page 89, it's real explicit. Find a prospect and start working on them. Doesn't say have a prospect find you. Somehow that's gotten into our jargon because people are coming into the rooms and we're not going out to get them. So now it's a dating service kind of deal. Well, it's worked. Some people have a spiritual connection and you have no other choice. So what else were you going to do? If you wanted it bad enough, it really didn't matter what the sponsor did or didn't do. What it counts on is when you give it back, you haven't got a clue what a sponsor does or doesn't do. You just wanted it bad enough. You counted on the meetings long enough to get through the big book. So that's where I see a lot of the problem. And then the spin dry deal, people coming in, coming out, you know, not getting passionate about the program. These folks, the early pioneers were passionate. They went out and did the deal. They took action. You don't see that now. People come into the meetings and it's social. It's a cross between a 12 group therapy, a self-help program, and a revival meeting. It's not what this thing was supposed to be. It was a way for us to find sponsees and connect up on the 12 steps. That's why, that's enough out of me. Would anybody else like to talk about me? Let me get back to the topic again. I was a militant smoker. And I'll tell you how I can relate to that. And sometimes the biggest sinner makes the best saint. I was winging my way home after being discharged from Army and leaving the country of Vietnam far behind. I was headed back to the world, the Big Apple and home. I was a militant dragon smoker, and this was the day when smoking was permitted in jet airliners. I was nervously puffing away. I was anticipating a second chance at life. The stewardess excused herself and inquired of me that an older gentleman, two rows back, had a heart condition and was being distressed by my cigarette smoke. I glanced over my shoulder and with a jaundiced eye and witnessed his distress and his ghostly pale pallor. You know what my response was, Harold?
No.
If he doesn't like him, tell him to get out and walk.
Mm-hmm.
No regard. No regard. Self-centered in the extreme. Didn't care about anything. I was going to have my smoke. I just got back from Vietnam, and I put my life on the line. I was going to smoke. Now, if the guy died, well, put him in a body bag and ship him home. So I'll get back to the story. The meeting at Champions Farms was about to start, and I had given some recovery cards out, but I knew the most good I could do was in the meeting announcing Rum Radio. as an AA-related announcement, sharing, and then dispensing the recovery cards. Usually I try to get a good share. And if I got a really good share and it connects up, people will be interested in more of what I have to say on the website, right? That makes sense. So I'd always try to get a good share. I had my good share. I met a black fellow who was also named Joseph and a non-smoker. We hit it off immediately. I asked, did he ever get tired of correcting people who called him Joe instead of Joseph? Yes, he replied constantly. I told him the reason people want to call him Joe is because they liked him, and it gave them a sense of presumptive familiarity. I get that all the time. We sat at a little back table from the rest of the group. They sat at a large conference table, the furthest we could get away from the spoke but still be part of the meeting. The first order of business was announcements. I made the rumradio.org announcement and was immediately challenged as to the veracity of being related to AA. I told them that we have the GSO stamp on the conference-approved literature page, and that seemed to suffice. The meeting was going to be a round robin that goes around the table in order, one to the next. I was far in the back, and chances were slim that I was going to get to me, and then the second-hand acrid smoke attack had not abated. I was gagging from time to time, but I decided to hang in. The shares were short and many passed. I had persevered, and it was my turn. I was really surprised that it went around that fast. I told the group how impressed I was that the shares were very succinct, brief, and timely. That the group as a whole was either very humble or there was a significant lack of oxygen in the room. Growing up in the rooms of recovery, I had learned that if you spoke more than 3 minutes, it was all about you anyway. After I had carried the message and my work, if not my deed, was done, the acrid tobacco attack seems to have at once abated. I knew something had just happened, but could not put my finger on it. It was odd that all of a sudden I got used to the environment. It was still funky, but no longer threatening and evasive. I gave out a bunch of cards and was welcomed back as I left for cleaner breathing pastures. That night it came to me. I was being attacked spiritually. Once the good work and the message was passed on, I had prevailed. There was no reason to continue the attack. I believe all pain and discomfort is spiritual by nature, and that you can't grow spiritually and be comfortable at the same time. Harold?
Yes, that's one of my mottos, being uncomfortable for the right reasons, being uncomfortable in order to grow. Very, very important to me, and it piggybacks on some of the statements by Dr. Scott Peck, where he encourages us to welcome the strange and the different, which is nice for Joseph and for me, because we are, well, I'm strange, he's different.
And then again, I'm differently strange. Or strangely different. Well, you know, Harold, it's funny you should say that. At church today, somebody mentioned that there was 7 billion people. I think it's actually 8 billion. Do you know how many in the world? Between 7 and 8 billion?
Yeah, between 7 and 8 right now.
Right. So basically, if you're 1 in a million, there's 7,500 people just like you. How unique is that? Can you imagine a room with 7,500 Harolds in it? Come on.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and that's if you're 1 in a million.
Yeah.
So what I realize is that the longer I'm in the program, and you know, and I read my scriptures, and I study, and I try to be in good works, that a spiritual understanding grows out of that. And that you start seeing things as spiritual, everything is spiritual by nature. And I believe that nicotine is a demon. Now, some people will dismiss it and, you know, what have you, but considering the amount of damage this thing does and the cost to life, property, and productivity, if it is a demon, it's one of the major players. And it goes really kind of under the radar. Well, not as much as it used to. At one time, everybody smoked. I mean, it was like you were weird if you didn't smoke. You know, everybody smoked. Everybody smoked everywhere all the time. In the movies, all the movie stars smoked. And if they smoked, you smoked. Politicians smoked. And doctors smoked. And, you know, everybody smoked. You remember those days, Harold?
I do. And, you know, the disturbing fact of the matter is in many of the smaller towns here in Texas around the Houston area, I can't even count the number of mothers, young mothers that I've talked to who reported to me. Now, I work in the recovery field sometimes, and these are women who have small children. They have CPS cases. They have doctors, or they've been assigned to doctors for their prenatal care, and their doctor told them that a glass of wine a day is okay while they're pregnant. Mm. Honest to God, these evidently it's small town doctors. If you're a doctor out there and you can, if you'd like to comment on that practice, telling women that they can drink a small amount on a daily basis, it's not harmful to their fetus. If you'd like to correct me on that, please call or email and set me straight. But all that I can find is that no amount of alcohol is recommended during pregnancy. None. Zero is the satisfactory amount during pregnancy to make sure that the fetus is not harmed. Several years ago, I studied the death rate, mortality rate of infant mortality rate. And I was thinking, and I looked to see how we compared to other developed countries. And about 4 years ago, I thought we'd be in the top three, surely. And when we weren't, I thought, well, maybe the top 10. Well, no, we were 19th in the world for infant mortality. And so a couple of months ago, I wondered again, I wonder if we've improved. And I went on and found that we were not 19th, we weren't 29th, we weren't even 39th, we were 42nd in the world. We've gotten worse as far as getting our babies to live their first year. So with attitudes like that from family doctors and OBGYNs promoting alcohol consumption during pregnancy, it's no surprise. We need to wake up. We need to wake up in this country and really understand the dangers of alcohol and nicotine. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. I almost like to do a study to see how many people relapse that have continued to smoke cigarettes and then ended up relapsing versus people who actually quit smoking and then relapse. I wonder if there'd be a connection. There might not be at all, but I would be curious because I know an addiction is an addiction is an addiction. Something what we can't stop despite our best efforts. But as long as you're not drinking and you're in AA, that's fine. But remember, part of recovery is considering the welfare of your neighbor. Are you harming someone else by this besides yourself? So that's where I think the program really comes into play. Am I being of maximum benefit to God and my fellows if I'm injuring them? No. You know, you don't cast anybody out of an AA meeting. Pardon me?
I talked to a man this month, in October, and he said that he's trying to figure out if he has a drinking problem. And I told him, if your wife thinks you have a drinking problem, you have a drinking problem. By definition.
Ah. You could say, you know, you might not have a drinking problem. You might just have a thinking problem. You know, when people are thinking about when they had their last drink, when they're going to have their next drink, and how long has it been in between, you might consider the fact that people who do not have that problem do not think like that.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're thinking about when you can add your last drink and when's your next one and how long has it been in between, it's time to consider taking a harder and longer look. Well, I guess we've done our hour. And did you click on the, did you send that out? The Facebook and the.
Yep.
Oh, good for you. Okay, Harold. Well, thank you for jumping in.
I'm catching on.
Pardon me?
I'm catching on.
Yes. Well, we learn until we die, hopefully. And then there's more to learn. I believe that this is all just a learning curve that never ends. I like to consider myself the perpetual student. As long as I think that's part of humility.
Once in a while, mine takes a hairpin turn.
when everyone becomes my teacher, men, women, and children, so much the wise and so few the fool, that everyone has a tale to tell if I'm humble enough to take the time and listen. And for a guy like me, it's so much harder to listen than to talk. But, hey, we all have our little character defects that we don't want to give away. So right now we're in 144 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We keep picking up islands. The last one we got, the Virgin Islands. We got the Faroe Islands, the Seychelles Islands, the Isle of Jersey. the islands keep getting smaller, but they're countries. So we're in 144 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're approaching 2,550 towns, cities, and villages, and 179,000 hits to the website. We're growing at about 600 hits a day. A lot of it's coming from Beijing, China. 1,600 in the moving week from Beijing. I don't know why Beijing. I think because the website has a spiritual lilt to it, and I think they've been deprived of any type of spirituality for such a long time that it's like dripping water on a dry sponge, I think. Otherwise, I have no idea why Beijing would find the website so fascinating. And I guess the logarithms of putting it into Mandarin or that many people speak English. I guess when I die and I'll ask those questions on the other side, there'll be more shall be revealed. But in the meantime, no money is being made. We're anonymous to the 11th tradition. And the credit for this work goes to God and the fellowship. So if you heard something that struck a chord, if you looked at the website and you found some tools to help the next sufferer and it helped you by helping the next sufferer, the one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. And if you want to really get some good information on sponsorship, rumradio.org. Good night, Harold. See you on the radio.